Welcome to the Real Python Podcast. This is episode 304. Which is more important, the model or the harness around an LLM? And what are the ways to assemble an efficient agentic developer workflow? This week on the show, Ian Pawa joins us to discuss harnessing, web scraping, and self-hosting Python applications. Ian is a developer advocate at Zeit and an experienced project builder. We discuss a recent article he wrote about creating an extension for the web scraping tool Scrapy. He also digs into his self-hosting setup for Python applications and tools. Our discussion extends to the complexities of developing effective harnesses. Ian shares his setup and how he navigated shifting from prompt engineering to context and loop engineering. This week's episode is sponsored by HydraDB. HydraDB is the fastest way to make your AI stateful. You ingest and connect your most important tools, and HydraDB automatically builds a context graph and returns useful context personalized for each user. Try HydraDB for free at hydradb.com/signup. All right, let's get started. The Real Python Podcast is a weekly conversation about using Python in the real world. My name is Christopher Bailey, your host. Each week, we feature interviews with experts in the community and discussions about the topics, articles, and courses found at realpython.com. After the podcast, join us and learn real-world Python skills with a community of experts at realpython.com. Hey, Ian, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk to you. I got sent your article through a different channel. Somebody from Real Python was like, hey, you should check this person out and check out what they're doing. And I already had looked at it because it was part of our PyCoders feed and it was about Scrapy. And I might actually, you know, mention it again later on the show.
Yeah.
But I was like, yeah, actually I used, that was one of the very first like sort of projects I built for somebody else. Like I had a,
oh, nice.
I always talk about this friend of mine who is in Hawaii who does like environmental science and unfortunately has to work with like testing buildings for asbestos and stuff like that. And there was all this like governmental documentation that was locked away on a website and they were threatening that it was just going to all go away. And he didn't want to spend the hours to click and download every single PDF on there. And I'm like, oh, this is perfect for this. And so I built a little...
Perfect use case.
Yeah, I totally built a spider with it and crawled the stuff with it. So yeah. You use Scrapy often?
Funny story, that was a project I was not planning to, you know, publish at all. So this happened, this happened to be in one of the content sprints that my team was doing as developer advocates at Zeit. We were out of ideas to do that week, and this was something that I wanted to do for quite long.
Yeah.
The funny story is, I am very new to the world of Scrapy in general compared to my other colleagues because they are into web scraping for a long time. So I decided, okay, let's. I've always been the person where I learn by doing something rather than reading the documentation.
Yes.
Even though it takes like a lot of mistakes and a lot of days, I would rather do something than, you know, prefer documentation. I know it sometimes bite in the ass, but that's fine. So that was another project that I decided to do it. Scrapy, as you might know, it's a really huge framework with a lot of moving parts. And I really wanted to figure out how everything works together. So I was like, okay, let's put a small extension. Let's bake one and see how the handover is happening from one place to another place. So simple 75 lines of code. And yeah, that was one of the initial projects that I did as my introduction to web scraping. I have used other tools to do web scraping in the past, but...
What were you using before?
Yeah, like the basic vanilla stuff, just to doing some casual request using curl, curl CFI library, and then using Beautiful Soups to, you know, extract some things out of it. I've also been using use Selenium in the past where JavaScript rendering is required.
Yeah.
But I think it's a perfect use case where you need to follow different links, different pages, and extract a lot of different products, a lot of different things from the website. So yeah, lately been doing a lot of Scrapy since I joined Zeit and totally in love with the framework.
Yeah, well, two questions there. The extension that you built, again, it's a neat article because it's sort of encouraging, which is what I love to do on the show, people to, you know, try something new, create a project, and it's not outside of, like, you know, you could do this in probably an afternoon or maybe, you know, part of a weekend as like a weekend project, which I think is always fun, especially for the summer here. You know, web scraping is always, I'm sure there's information on the web that you want in some way or not as a Python developer.
Sure.
So that's one thing I really liked about it. And your particular project was to sort of give you alerts like when it's done, which I think is kind of cool too. I was very early on in the CD burning era and so forth. I don't know if you remember Toast, but it would make a very loud ding kind of sound when it was done. And my wife would always go, "Hey, your toast is done." It would always do that anyway. So it's like these weird little announcements. So you kind of added these fanfares to it, but it, again, shows the structure of how to build an extension, which I think is neat. But I guess the question is, you know, you work for Zeit, and I think it's a nice sort of partnership with something like Scrapy. In fact, I think it's mentioned a couple times, even just on the website for it. But like, maybe explain what it is and how it helps with, you know, we often talk about the problems of trying to do web scraping and the moving target that is the JavaScript frameworks and trying to just even get, you know, things through that.
Of course. Yeah. So Scrapy is like a very opinionated, batteries included, async scraping framework. The way I like to say it is what Django is for the web development, Scrapy is for the scraping.
Yeah.
Basically, how it all works is you write a spider, tell it where to start, which URLs to follow. It handles the pagination. It extracts the stuff that you want. Like you mentioned, there were a lot of PDFs on the government website. You wanted to automate it. So all these things can be done. It handles the scheduling. It handles the download. So the spider also looks for, you can actually program if you want to change something, maybe the format or put some information into the database. All these things can be handled by framework.
Yeah.
So Zeit is the one who actually maintains the Scrapy. They are the original developers of the framework.
Oh, okay.
Zeit was originally known as Scraping Hub, and that's where a lot of people knows Zeit and Scrapy from. What I really like about it, it's a very holistic framework. So you can actually do a lot of different stuff with it. And that's where my extensions comes into the picture. So just to, you know, give you a brief about it, it's a very small 75-line Scrapy extension, which looks for the scraping timeline. So if the spider is finished and all the scraping items that you want it to be fetched, if it's successful, then it's played a very loud sort of a triumphant that, okay, yes, success, it's successful. And if not, then it plays a very sort of a sad tune, and it's give you a sort of a feedback, because when you are scraping thousands and millions of items, you don't need to babysit the terminal. You can just look for this feedback.
Right.
And that's where I wanted to build this project.
You could probably have it running as a process in the background.
Right on, right on.
Get alerted that way. Yeah.
So that's all the moving parts. So the extension, there are a lot of different extensions made by Zeit and made by different community members, because this is a very scalable framework and you can do a lot with it. For example, you can change the downloader, you can change how you are handling the extraction logic, how you're handling the crawling logic, how do you are following the pagination, you can handle all these things. So there are a lot of different extensions. I really wanted to understand how this all tie together. So what happens when the spider fails, and what are the conditions, and what happens if one item is scraped and it goes to the next one. So all these things where the signals are. So that project captures it very well. So at the end, it looks for the success messages. It looks for the number of scraped item if it matches what user wants. So yes, you get your Scrapy triumphant. Otherwise, you get a sound, you get a sad tone, so you can fix your spider.
Sad trombone. Yeah. So the thing that Zeit is sort of known for besides Scrapy would be the sort of API to help basically, if you're being blocked potentially for, you know, what might be considered bot activity, it can help you sort of manage that and maybe schedule that. And I don't know, I'm still kind of learning a little bit about it, but what does Zeit provide for this?
Yeah, sure. So Scrapy is the entire ecosystem, or so to speak, framework for web scraping. But web scraping, scraping a page is just one part of the job. If you're doing at scale, if you're, you know, want to have data get from a lot of different websites, a lot of different page, oftentimes the not you find yourself not able to do that because you might get blocked, or your IPs are limited, or that sometimes you the user don't want you to, you know, to be scraping their website. So Scrapy respects all that. So there are different ways to do it. For example, in the Scrapy settings, you can actually by default, it totally respect what the site owners wants you to do. Although you can change that being an open source framework, that's a flexibility. But if you know what you are doing and if you want to, you know, do at scale, then Site API comes into the picture. And the best thing is you can use that independently and you can also plug it into the Scrapy. So Site is sort of a single API call. Whatever you want, you get a good structured data in the HTML and then you can go about it. So both of these works together really well, but you can also use Site totally independent of Scrapy.
Yeah. So, and just as a note, if people wanted to check it out, there is like a free tier for people to try some of this stuff out.
Yeah. So you can try it for free. There are some credits that you can get. There are also some other ways to try a site. So, for example, the way web scraping works is you need to first understand how the web is structured. The HTML is where if you want something, you need to go and see what are the selectors.
Yes.
CSS, XPath. At Site API, there are also some features like automatic extraction. So you can just say that this is a product website or this is a blog website and Site API handles everything. So you don't have to write brittle selectors because today you might be able to scrape the page, but tomorrow website owners decide to change something and the scraper will break, right? So automatic extraction is one feature that Site also provides if you don't want to get into that creeping logic or writing brittle paths.
Yeah. Anybody who's tried to do it and use something like Beautiful Soup, you end up learning what right. web pages can be made out of and what all the different descriptors are and all that sort of stuff.
100%.
Navigating, yeah. Vector search can be reasoning blind and meaning blind. It finds the closest matching embeddings to your query and stops there. It also serves identical results to everyone, failing to take into account user preferences and memories. Most teams building stateful AI end up stitching together five systems: a vector database, a graph database, a relational store, file system primitives, and a cache. You spend months planning, write brittle code, maintain it constantly, and everything still fails in production. Ultimately, your agents and evals suffer. HydraDB solves that by giving you one graph that learns every user preference, retains every agent experience, and delivers personalized context the moment your agent needs it. Try HydraDB for free at hydradb.com/signup. You are a busy person. You do lots of different things, which I think is great. And I like having people come on the show to just occasionally, and I've kind of haven't had a chance to do that as often lately, but you do a lot of different projects, which I think is really cool and kind of inspiring. And one of them is really warmed my heart because I'm having the same problem. And it's your No Algo YouTube project, which kind of touches on a couple different things, but maybe explain like why you wanted to have this project and what it does.
Yeah, sure. So I think like most people in our community, in the tech community in general, YouTube is one of the sources where we, you know, consume a lot of different information, podcasts, webinars, even some fun videos, not judging, but that's one of my sources of all the information. So what happened eventually is I have subscribed to a lot of different channels and it's really hard to keep track on, but there's always some top 10 or 20 channels that I don't want to miss no matter what happening. I always want to stay on the top whenever they're launching content. But funny enough, I have been finding myself, I would say, in the last 12 to 14 months that YouTube has been recommending me stuff that I don't really care about.
Yeah.
The channels that I don't really want. And it's sort of hiding stuff that I really want to see. So that was the frustration that I tried to solve. Basically, Semi wipe coded this project called No Algo Tool. There I can go and it's a good front end. So you can add the YouTube channels that you want. So currently I've had like 12 different channels over here, which I don't want to miss at all cost. And it basically bypasses the YouTube algorithm. Because at 3 a.m. in the morning, sometimes I want to understand why blue whales are at a particular pale place, but I am not a zoologist, right? When I wake up, I still want to go back to happening in the world of Python. So not polluting the algorithm.
Yeah, and you got to watch out for all the for all the AI-generated animal stuff.
Right.
Trying to make sure that it's realistic or not.
Yeah. So I don't want to have multiple YouTube channels, but I still want to, you know what's happening with this channel. So all the channels are there. And whenever they have a new video up, I just open the NoAlgoTube website, which is hosted on my local server. And then I just see it. The next step that I did is I also added a blog RSS feed because, hey, why not? So all the blogs are there. All the good videos are there. So I just check
it. Yeah, so you were probably a Google Reader person then maybe back in the
day. Yeah, totally. So all the RSS feed are there. And the only component where web scraping happened into this project is sometimes the RSS feed doesn't work for YouTube for some reason. So the project automatically falls back to scraping the YouTube. But yeah, that's about it. So yeah, that's about the project. And
It's a bunch of different little components. Like, you know, you can always look at GitHub and see like the percentages of different things. And, you know, in this case, of course, it's going to have HTML and CSS.
Yeah.
And then you have, you know, Python. And then I believe it's, you know, hosting in a container.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a Docker container.
They've got the architecture, right?
Yeah, totally.
Okay.
So it's just a Docker container, which sits on my home server. It's a very small NUC server. And I have actually, you know, created this pipeline. So if I make any changes, then it definitely goes and do all the CI/CD and deploy directly into it. So yeah, that's where I really like all this containerization stuff and all this makes sense for me.
Yeah, yeah. So if people want to check it out, you know, I'll include links for both these, you know, different, you know, not only the article, but the GitHub link for NoAlgo YouTube. And that kind of led me to like the other area that you're into, which is sort of self-hosting. I was mentioning to you right before we began that I have a Synology, which has some advantages to it because it's kind of a, you know, network attached storage, plus it's sort of a little bit of a Linux computer and it can, you could put Docker containers in it. And I haven't quite done, I think it's Home Assistant, I think is the big home networking thing.
Yeah.
I have a variety of devices and my wife probably doesn't want to hear about how I can't get anything to connect sometimes. You know, oh, Matter, what, 7.9 or whatever is going to finally solve all this.
Totally, yeah.
Anyway.
Very relatable.
Yeah. But I've been thinking about like hosting other things. I you know, do a little bit of movie stuff on there. What are the kinds of projects that you're putting on that? Obviously, you put NoAlgo YouTube. You explain pretty well, I think, partly in both of those different sort of articles on your blog, which we'll include a link to also. I don't know, where did you get started with this stuff and what's your setup kind of look like? We don't have to go all the way, all the nuts and bolts, but...
Yeah, sure. So I just did the revamp of my home lab from grounds up in the last 6 months, and I am on a backlog of writing about it. I think I just published one blog and there are still three more blogs to go. But
stay tuned.
But just to give you a small background, so for before doing web scraping and coming up to this level of stack, I was working very close to the hardware, being an embedded engineer, writing firmware and low-level Linux and kernels and whatnot. So contributed to MicroPython and CircuitPython, and I discovered a single board computer called Raspberry Pi, and that's where this entire journey of home labbing and self-hosting started. So the very first thing that I did is a project called Pi Block or Ad Block, which is just a Pi hole ad blocker. So it's like a DNS server ad blocker. So again, frustrated with seeing a lot of different ads, instead of, you know, paying for each platform, it's good to block ads on the DNS level. So that was my first introduction with home labbing.
Potentially malicious, that stuff is.
Exactly. So Pi-hole was the very first thing that I hosted, and it grew from there. So I started just using my old laptops, so the Dells and the Lenovo's and whatnot, and started hosting small services on bare metal initially, and then to Linux. And then finally, I settled to this Proxmox, which is like a virtual hypervisor where you can create different virtual machines.
Okay.
So I'm just looking at the dashboard of my home lab, and there are different things that I do. So the first thing is OpenSense, which is like the entire firewall of my home. So all this firewall activity is happening from here. Everything is, this is an open source firewall.
What was the name again?
It's OpenSense, OpenSense. So it's like a firmware for your router. So basically, if you know, your router is just not the router. It's a firewall, it's a bridge, it's a modem, it's a router, it's a DNS server, and so many things.
Yeah.
So if you want a better control, you can just, you know, divide all those things. And OpenSense is like the first layer. Any network coming into my home goes through this, and this is the one that I can truly control. ISP cannot see it.
Okay.
And then as a As I mentioned, Proxmox is there. So this runs on one of my home lab computer. This allows me to create virtual machines using CLI and Python scripts and whatnot. And on this, one of the virtual machine is a Linux Debian server. And that's where all the interesting stuff is happening. So again, I am using Home Assistant. As you mentioned, all the IoT devices are connected over here.
Yeah.
Small ESP8266 nodes. So, and then I also use it for a lot of different experimentation. So if there is a new Linux distro is coming up, if something I want to test with the latest and greatest version of Python.
You just stand it up in a like a container or something? Or what do you end up doing?
Yeah, I end up creating, firing up a new virtual machine. And then I just, you know, try the ISOs there.
Okay.
So what else? I have a reverse proxy, so I can also... I have a small domain, so all the service lives on the domain. I can generate SSL certificates, because one of the things that is really frustrated in home labbing is everything is on local network.
Yeah.
And the browser keeps asking for the SSL, so that thing is taken care of.
It doesn't want you to go there. Okay, yeah, interesting. Yeah.
I also have over here this very good service called Kavita, which is an open source book hosting library. So all the books that I purchase digitally are stored over here. So I can just access it from anywhere in the world, use on my iPad and keep reading it.
Okay.
One very interesting tool is OmniTool. So this is something that I share with a lot of my colleagues. So this is one tool that gives you access to multiple tools like splitting PDF, merging PDFs, changing images from JPEG to PNG.
Okay.
And the best part is the data never leaves your home. So everything is self-hosted. So even if you're uploading a photo to change format or just removing the background, it all happens on the local network. So that's one tool that I really like. And yeah.
Can you give that name again one more time?
Yeah, it's called OmniTools. So it's available on GitHub.
OmniTools.
Yeah, okay. I'm going to share the link well. You can put over there.
Yeah. No, you're going to have to be giving me an email with all this stuff and we'll put it all in the show notes.
And lastly is my NVR, the network video recorder. It's again an open source tool called Frigate. And this one, the computer this is running on, it's dedicatedly running this. And it has a small USB Coral device attached. I think it was launched a couple of years ago by Google. So it's doing sort of edge detection and person detection and dog detection on the fly on using that USB accelerator. So yeah, just monitoring some cameras. There are 3-4 cameras around my home. So just using that to monitor. And whenever I'm out of the home, it just sends me alert that, hey, a wild dog might appear if you want to take a look.
Yeah,
that's all about.
Yeah, I've been considering changing cameras. I currently have a popular system that's out there, but it, you know, it says it has detection and so forth, but it just detects the movement of the trees.
Yeah,
because the wind is kind of insane here in Colorado Springs. Looking at, maybe I could find something that's a little better about that process. Awesome. Yeah, that stuff all sounds fun. And I like diving into some of these experiments. And you sound like you have spent some time with MicroPython and CircuitPython and some of those projects. So if people are interested in that stuff, definitely you can check out your site.
Yeah.
The other conversation I really wanted to get into is going into the AI world. And we were, again, kind of just briefly mentioning at the beginning before we started. And it's just so fast how things are moving, the terminology that if you're not putting your head into the fire hose of Twitter or whatever, even YouTube, and learning how all these people are talking. You know, I'm so far outside of what's happening in Silicon Valley and what's happening inside all the AI labs. I get to meet some of those people from time to time, but even from them, I feel like the terminology keeps changing. And so I thought maybe we could have a discussion about that, a discussion about, you know, kind of like maybe where you got started in this stuff and then how it's evolved. And I think following a journey of somebody working in this stuff. But I thought maybe we'd start with this term that is getting thrown around more and more. And I think it's just something that they've figured out a way to sort of define a little bit more. But the term is a harness.
Yeah.
And I think it's a great term. You know, I love doing metaphors. And I think it's a pretty common metaphor in this sense of like, okay, you know, you have the horsepower literally of this LLM or these tools, and the harness is, you know, literally like, okay, I want to attach a cart to a horse, or I want to harness, you know, some of its other stuff. It could be just a saddle initially if it's just you going around, but it could be something much more complex. And the metaphor I gave the other day as I was just sort of thinking about it is I have this friend who's like really into cars. and, you know, working on stuff and building things. And he has this massive air compressor, this super powerful machine, but by itself, it doesn't really do anything unless you just want to blow air everywhere. You have to attach things to it, and you have to like get machinery and all of that attachment and so forth focuses what the thing does and how it kind of works. And again, just similar to this idea of harnessing what it can do.
Yeah.
I think there's a variety of metaphors there. But yeah, how would you describe like what goes into a modern harness today?
Yeah, so I think the easiest way that I look at it is a lot of people are talking about AI agents, and the general consensus that everyone agrees on that AI that does stuff instead of, you know, suggesting what to do and you go and do stuff, those are AI agents, right? So
versus just a back and forth chatting.
Exactly. Type of thing. Exactly. Okay. So if you look at the AI agents, I feel that AI agent is nothing but a model and a harness. So a model could be, if people are into the Anthropic ecosystem, so a model could be the Opus or the Sonnet or the Fable. They just give it back to the
all the stuff you keep hearing, all the headlines about.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. And the harness is where you are using the model. So, for example, some people could be chatting with the Sonnet and Opus on a web page on Claude.ai. So that chat ecosystem becomes your harness. Some people are actually using the same model, but inside the Claude code in their terminal or in a VS code, and it's writing the files, it's spitting out the code and validating your code and checking pull requests. So the Claude code in this case is the harness. They recently launched something called Claude for Slack. So in this case, the same model, the Opus and the Sonnet, is the model, but the Slack becomes the harness where you are calling the model. So I would say I've written a blog about it. It's a harness engineering on Zite, and there I tried to explain what I feel is a harness and the way that I feel the industry is heading. That recently Satya Nadella, CEO of Microsoft, he wrote a very good blog. He haven't mentioned harness in it, but if I have to take something out of it, I would take that. I'm taking that. What he's trying to say that a model is becoming a commodity, and the real thing with which happening is all going into the harness. So essentially, how I like to say it is, if you are doing a task today, and tomorrow, if you replace the model that you're using with some other model and the task breaks, then your harness is one that you need to fix and start working on. So all the tools that you provide to the model, maybe it's the MCP, maybe it's the bash, maybe it's the Python script, maybe it's a tool to scrape the web, all these tools that your model can see, that becomes the harness.
Yeah.
And one important thing that harness is responsible for is actually context management. So everything that you are telling inside the harness, even if you're chatting it, the model doesn't have a previous memory of what you said so far. So it's a job of the harness to send the entire conversation again and again. Because whenever you are calling a model, the API call is stateless. It's just giving the fresh context. So just to keep the model updated that, hey, we have already talked about this, the harness is sending all the entire conversation with the entire new call. So even if you are writing a hi, if you have done 10,000 messages before hi, all the 10,000 messages is being sent with that hi to the model with an API call. So that makes harness really important. And that also raises the question that should people be using the harnesses that companies are supplying, for example, Claude Code, or should they start building their own harnesses? And I see some companies, or some organizations, they have started working in that direction.
Yes.
There are some really good open source harnesses. One of them is Open Code, which I use really a lot with all my models. Eventually, what I feel is model will become a commodity, and we can essentially be replacing it with a cheaper model, with a faster model, with a local model for all those different reasons. Your reason could be different from mine. Maybe you are more privacy conscious and you want a local model. I want speed because my task depends on that. So model should be swappable, but harness is the one which stays and which scales with your use case.
Yeah, it's been sort of pluggable in a sense that you could choose whatever engine you want to put in there, and it could be, you know, a local one. Maybe you consider it like a battery powered kind of thing. Like,
yeah,
it's something that, you know, it's running on your own local energy and so forth, versus, okay, I'm going to rent this machinery for this job I'm going to do this week. And then I'd reach out and use something else. So
exactly,
if you can plan your architecture and it works the way that you want, you're customizing like how it wants to, how it works. And that's really been the thing to watch. I mean, I've had these conversations with Jody Virtual a bunch about, like, you know, LLMs have a certain amount of finite stuff that they can kind of do. And I think that the idea that LLMs are going to turn into AGIs already, everybody's sort of, I think, on the moment, like, yeah, that's probably not what's going to happen with it. It's going to be a component of some other things. The big, big high-end models seem to be providing you very large context windows. They're providing you some of their own pre-tuning.
Yeah.
And optimization. And so you're getting this sort of machinery that, you know, you can use, like, okay, I'm going to do this job now. So maybe we could go back a little bit. Like, were you early on in this and jumping into this sort of stuff and building harnesses? And what tools were you using initially? Were you just simply looking at, like, I'm going to, you know, work on my initial prompts, skills I feel like were kind of a second step.
Yeah.
But where did you start with this?
Yeah, we kind of have this joked about it recently in my team that we were just learning prompt engineering and they moved to context engineering. And and when we started context engineering, the world is talking about loop engineering, so to speak, now. So it's really hard to catch up. But
yeah.
I think what I'm doing is definitely from a perspective of someone who likes to keep trying new stuff that's coming up. I'm really trying to...
Yeah, you like to experiment.
Yeah, to experiment, to learn, to see how I can increase my productivity. I'm really still trying to figure out what is the ideal operating system, agentic operating system for me. I can definitely see that agents have helped me boost my productivity. Agents are definitely helping me to extend that I can do more work, do better work, and have a partner, especially in a remote job like me. It can get sometimes lonely, and it's good to always have a coding buddy or a co-pilot where you can, you know, just discuss ideas. So I'm still trying to find the right agentic setup for me. So that helps me keep experimenting with the new models that coming up or new harnesses that coming up. Some sticks, some are just, you know, just try and leave and move to the next. Tools becomes really important. And that's where I think the entire vibe coding thing, what I'm doing is if I like the tool and if the tool doesn't come with a really good API or a CLI or an MCP server, then I vibe code and make my own and just attach it to my harness.
Okay.
So for example, coming back to Zite API and web scripting, we are planning to launch the MCP server and we recently launched Claude Skill. So Claude Code and other harnesses, they have a built-in web fetch tool. So if you are asking your agent to do some research for you and it's going out on the web, so there are high chances that the agent will be blocked because everyone is using it and it has some IP attached to it. So there could be multiple reasons why your agents could be blocked and the agents could come back. They could still confidently give you the answer, but their research is incomplete because they were not able to unblock some of the pages that where the real answers or real things lies, right? So thinking in that direction, you can create the tool using Zite API. So that's what we did. We have an unofficial sort of tool that we have created within our team. And we have added into the Claude.md that anytime you get banned for any reason, you are seeing HTTP 403 or, you know, whatever, just fall back to Zite API and ask Zite API to get you the HTML of that page. So I'm seeing great results with that. So using this, we can unblock the pages and we can get better result, latest documentation and whatnot. So I think these tools will become really important. And a lot of people I have been seeing, they're vibe coding these tools. There has been a debate between CLI and MCP. Irrespective of which team you are in, I think it's a great time to use these models to build those tools and keep building the tool library. So eventually that tool library will become your harness. And I think I'm at the stage where I'm figuring out what tools are required for my workflow. And if this tool exists, good, I will just add them to my harness. And if not, then I wipe code them.
Okay. So where did you start though? Like, what were you very early on playing with ChatGPT and trying out different things like that, like vibe coding with that?
Yeah. Not very early on, to be honest. I actually procrastinated for a long time thinking it's something that's not going to stick for a long time.
Sure.
Yeah. There's
dozens of us.
Yeah. but it sticked. It sticked for good. At some point, I felt that ChatGPT is just some chat and people are doing some workflows. So I started trying to do some coding with the Copilot, GitHub Copilot, and that was really an eye-opening thing.
Okay.
I could see that, yes, this is something that I could do. It can code, it can learn my style, and it can code the way I want. And then eventually, recently, I would say a couple of months ago, I shifted to Claude Code. And instead of just coding on the side, you can plan together and then ask it to code. So it's like a junior programmer, always available with you. And eventually, you can see that it's good at it and it's keep getting better. So there might be a time that I don't code at all, but I still like to keep my skills sharp. So I still code every now and then.
Yes.
But yeah, agentic is something that I am totally bullish on. I feel that even on the non-coding task, for example, just, you know, managing my portfolio, just telling me how much stocks that I have in which category, what is the asset allocation, I still fall back to these tasks because manually scanning the PDFs, it's very error prone and it's real time taking. And I was always putting these kind of stuffs on back burner. So I've started doing more and more stuff on agentic, and I can definitely see that it's going to be something that I can totally work with. The way that I have set up my harnesses, it's very easy for me to test a new model as soon as it arrives. It's very easy for me to test a new tool. So because I still know that it's a very early day, so I have written a blog about it, my agentic setup, it's on Zite. So basically, there is a service called OpenRouter, and OpenRouter gives you a flexibility that using one API key, you can call multiple different models. So they have all the models, just tell the name which model you want the response from, and it will give you that. An open source coding agent called OpenCode. So this is my go-to setup, which I'm very happy with. And whenever a new model comes, whenever a new tool comes that I want to experiment with, I just make some changes. Sometimes I even ask my agent to make those changes, write me a new shell script or a new alias. And just with that, I am very ready to test a new model and do some stuff with it.
Yeah, I've been hearing about OpenRouter from a variety of people. And I mentioned it on the show recently also. I, you know, jokingly said it's, you know, like having a prepaid, you know, if you're old enough, prepaid phone card, where you can kind of choose what you want, you know, you kind of can do that. And then I said, well, or maybe you go to like a wine bar or something like that, and you have a certain amount of tokens on there, if you will, to try different things out.
Yeah. In fact, just yesterday, I put together one very small project. So while making YouTube videos, I'm always doing this creating of thumbnails. So what I did, I put together a small script. It calls three top image generation models on OpenRouter with your design.md, and it gets three thumbnails. So you can compare which thumbnail you want. And on YouTube, you can do A-B testing, right? So I can put all three thumbnails and get the result. So yeah, I think it's really good. So the majority of development on the flagship level is still happening on the model. Then comes the harnesses, and then comes this router where you can, you know, route different models and do all kind of things. And I think it's at each level there is something to learn, and I'm very much looking forward to more doing learning in this department.
There's a bunch of things that are happening kind of behind the scenes that, you know, we touched on a lot of recent developments already, but one of them that I think is really interesting is the having local models and running them yourself and kind of picking and choosing between them and seeing what performs well, not only for the tasks that you want to do, but, you know, will run on your own local hardware. And there's been a lot of hiccups there too, you know, with just the cost of, you know, Apple just raised their prices. They were holding out for a little while, but they got to keep them margins. Storage is following in suit. It's not quite the prices, you know, that when I got into computing, but, you know, comparatively. But are you trying out and like using something like, say, you know, Llama or something like that, and trying some local stuff? And if so, like what's working for you?
Yeah, same constraint when it comes to memory, when it comes to compute. The really good models that I wish that I had compute to run for, unfortunately, I don't, even though I have some decent sort of a server power, but it's still not enough when it comes to GPUs and VRAM.
Yeah,
I think one of the recent model that I tried was Google Gemma 4. It has a 2 billion parameter one, which you can also run on the phone. And that sort of development really makes me very happy coming from an embedded background. So if I can run a local model on an edge device and do some sort of intelligence, I think that would be really good, especially if the inference is happening. There's an entire sort of a field called edge AI, where people are doing inference on edge devices like small microcontrollers and small single board computers. So I think
That term edge is really interesting.
Yeah,
I think that gets lost in translation for a lot of people, but that's
true.
Literally doing it all the way out at the user's hand, if you will.
True that.
Is that kind of like the idea? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like, you know, on a small device, on, you know, something that's potentially removed from
network,
this cloud idea.
Like, for example, if I want to do a human detection on my camera, then instead of sending all the video frames on the camera vendor cloud, I would rather have a small sort of a chipset on the camera itself, which is doing the inference. So yeah, that's definitely the very idea of the edge.
Right.
So MoE is a category of models. which I think if the development happens in those departments, then we might be able to run some good models locally. So basically the idea is not all the model weights get activated when you are trying to inference something. So model has billions and trillions of parameters, right? But if the model knows that you want something specific, so it only activates those specific category of weights. So that was one of the models that Google Gemma launched. So I think we are still very far running local models, especially the foundational models that we really like running from the cloud APIs. And the cost of memory and the compute is skyrocketed, as you rightly said. So yes, I still want to do it, but no, I'm not being able to do it. Though I am keeping Ollama installation and LM Studio and whatnot, hoping that a time would come that I would still be able to do it.
Yeah, that's the one, LM Studio. Yeah, that's a good one.
It's a good one.
I've been looking at that one too. Yeah, you guys had a recent podcast. I'm guessing it's a podcast. I'm not sure. It was a YouTube video that I saw from, I'm guessing those are coworkers at Zeit. Is that right?
Yeah, correct.
Okay. Yeah. And you were talking about a lot of the stuff, and that's why I kind of wanted to dive into it a little bit more. And you kind of talked a little bit about Apple. Apple's having an interesting year, actually interesting 2 years, where they're trying to figure out what they're going to do with their devices and, you know, kind of balancing. They are always like harping on the idea of, you know, privacy and keeping things running locally, or we're going to use Google's models, but we're going to restructure them so they use our cloud compute and don't, you know, send any information back.
Yeah.
And I'm intrigued by all of it. And then, you know, obviously to me, because I'm a big Apple nerd, I am excited about this Siri, partly because it looks like they're going to fix Spotlight on everybody's computers and devices, because that's always been like, their index is just broken. And I really, you know, being a bit of a database nerd, I'm like, well, how are they fixing it? Like, cause it, I mean, mail messages, all these different things that Siri was supposed to be able to communicate with, like, you know, how are they restructuring it? Are they maybe using vectors, or like, what are they doing to kind of improve it? And of course, you know, the pundits that talk in that realm don't ever get that nerdy and ask this question. So I'm kind of intrigued by what they're going to do with it and what that might mean for maybe unleashing some of that to like us as end users. Is like, so many people are like, let me take all of my notes and put them in text files and then build like some kind of Obsidian or whatever kind of knowledge base or whatever. I'm like,
yeah,
that sounds really cool, except for all the work. And so like, if somebody else could already, you know, run a crawler on all of my local stuff, that would be really kind of handy. So anyway, I guess I'm more doing a commentary on it, but.
No, I totally relate to it. So I think one of the interesting thing to look for, again, being an Apple nerd here as well, the new CEO is coming from the Silicon sort of the team. And
yeah, he's a hardware dude.
Yeah. I'm definitely looking forward to seeing some advancement in the hardware, especially when they decided to move all the Macs on the ARM architecture from Intel. I think that was a major leap. And
yes,
I was really worried at how industry going to react and if I would be able to run Docker or Python on my ARM-based MacBook. But
yes,
they literally, you know, segued into it and the entire industry followed. And I never really felt that I'm having a CPU on MacBook. I was never really felt left behind. So that one thing is for sure, if Apple does something, then the entire ecosystem follows and follows really quickly. So that's one thing that I'm looking forward to. What's the new CEO will come up with? Hopefully something in the chipset space, which could enable more local models to run.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the architecture, they keep adding these additional chips. And the first 3 or 4 years, I was like, what are they going to do with that?
Yeah.
Like, I kind of kept wondering, like, okay, well, yeah, you're doing all this stuff and you mention it and then it doesn't really do much, you know? And then suddenly it's like, oh,
I don't know if you have seen this, but right,
this is making,
I don't
sense.
Know if you've seen this, but there are some people who are combining multiple Mac studios and now they're able to run these big flagship open weighted models with it. So just 2 or 3 Mac studios and you can run Quen or Kimi or sort of a model. So the architecture is definitely solid. I would say they have figured something out, but yeah, I have disabled Siri because it doesn't work for me. I really wish it does. And I now that I'm thinking out loud after you mentioned, I do feel that a vector database and having a rack pipeline running locally, that would make a lot of sense. And yeah, definitely see some potential there. Let's see how they do it.
it's time to shine a spotlight on another RealPython video course. Web scraping is the process of collecting and parsing raw data from the web, and the Python community has come up with some pretty powerful web scraping tools. And this video course is titled Introduction to Web Scraping with Python. It's based on a written tutorial by David Amos. And in the video course, Martin Broyce takes you through how to parse data using string methods and regular expressions, parse website data using an HTML parser, interact with forms and other website components, and how to work with tools like Beautiful Soup and Mechanical Soup. Through the course, you also learn how to scrape ethically and follow best practices. This course also has a full exercise course you can continue with to practice everything you've learned. RealPython video courses are broken into easily consumable sections, and where needed, include code examples for the techniques shown. All lessons have a transcript, including closed captions. Check out the video course. You can find a link in the show notes, or you can find it using the search tool on realpython.com. Yeah. I mean, it's just the economics of everything is kind of a little skewed. And I'm hearing more and more talk about, you know, we've already mentioned tokens. We've already mentioned kind of like what's involved there. And they've been underpricing them the whole time, literally losing money. You know, you're spending $20 a month and, you know, it's costing them, you know, what, $2,000 or something like that, probably behind the scenes. And that switch has to flip, you know, like I see it as like this big Frankenstein switch and they're just slowly like lifting it and moving it toward like where it's going to be. And, you know, different corporations are having like these wake up calls, like, holy cow, like, what did we spend on all this money, you know, like on tokens and so forth. And so there's been some trends, and that's part of maybe the harness too of like, well, how can I maybe minimize versus maximize, because that was like the term that was really kind of stupid, like token maxing, like anything with the word max has been really kind of not great lately, in my opinion, maxing of things. Are you using different things with that yourself, like to like, as part of your harness, like ways that you're looking at like, okay, well, how do I keep this efficient, keep this not repeating lots of different stuff? And, you know, one of the things that I always was weirded out by was just the how flowery everything was of like, oh, yes, that's an amazing idea, what you've created here. I'm like, I don't need any of that. Like, just speak to me plainly. And I've heard of Caveman that's been like sent to me like four times recently, people talking about it, like just like, you know, do this now.
Yeah.
Yes, that's good. You know, kind of like, you know, speaking kind of thing. Is that stuff that you're looking at and ways that you're looking at optimizing your usage?
No, I know what you mean. So yes and no, to be honest. So I'll give you one example. So recently I tested this new model by one of the Chinese lab. It's getting quite famous and getting for good reason. It's GLM 5.2 from ZAI.
Okay.
So if you look at the raw API cost and what company is claiming, it should be around 1/10 of what Claude is asking for their flagship models. So on the paper, it's very cheap, right? On the paper, you should be able to just reduce your bill by 1/10. But if you actually take that into practice, then this model is very thorough. It likes to speak to you, and it likes to speak to you in a 2,000 words paragraph for even a single messages. So if you look at the overall token economics, yes, it's cheaper, but because it's spitting out so many tokens and it's asking you to be thorough with it, at the end of the day, your bill might be more compared to what you are spending on Claude. So that's where I think the tools and the harnesses would make really sense. Caveman is definitely one of them. I have tried it, not a huge fan, because but there's one that I recently installed just a couple of days ago called Ponytail. So if you look at the GitHub readme, the idea is somewhat relatable if you're anywhere close to the software industry. So it says that in every software development team, there is a guy with pony with the big glasses, and he really speaks in very few words. But when it comes to writing,
super terse,
when it comes to writing code, it gives you the most optimized piece of a function that could run on anywhere, not just your machine. So this is the tool that you can give to your AI coding agents. And it's definitely giving me really good results.
I'm trying to remember the Silicon Valley character.
Oh, yes, I know what you mean.
What's his name? Yeah, yeah.
Guilfoyle, I believe.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Yeah, just like him. So I would feel that a lot of these tools would really make sense, especially for the vibe coders who are optimizing for the cost. And not sure how many people will be token maxing once they stop giving you subsidy, which all the companies are now giving.
Yeah.
So yeah, definitely looking forward to more such tools. But I would say that this is something that we can all do ourselves. Just understand how you are interacting with it, how many words you are comfortable with it, if you want a thorough plan and whatnot, and then start tuning your Claude.md or Agent.md, whatever harness you're using it. So I do use tools, but instead of taking 100% of what tool has to offer, I just take the pieces that is relevant for my use case and then uninstall it.
Yeah, you're folding it into your prompt files. Like, so give me what is your setup look like? I think of again, I spent a bunch of time talking about spec-driven development, and that there's people that are doing things like, separating things into like four separate different files. Like, this is for, the architecture, and this is for,
planning,
the testing, and planning and things like that. And then there's other people like, you don't need to do all that. You can just put it all in like, say, one, file. What does, maybe your setup look like?
Yeah, sure. So I just, randomly said it in one of our YouTube video ads, that what I believe is flirt with all the models, but marry one harness. So that's where I'm coming from. So my harness, choice of harness is Open Code on the top, and the next is Claude Code.
Okay.
So these are the two, and I keep swapping models depending on what I want. So as of now, what I'm doing is Opus for everything planning, and Sonnet and Haiku for execution and file IO. There is one tool that I specifically love for using search. It's called Exa.ai, which is doing semantic search for everything. So that's something that really good. And for everything on the web, if it's getting blocked, then fall back to Zytavia. So this is my bare minimum tools. And I've given access to my shell, which can, run grep and ls and whatnot and write Python code. Now, coming back to how everything is wired together. So,
yeah, is that like a set of files that are configured in Open Code? Are you like creating modifying preferences? Is it like a GUI kind of thing, or is it all just in text files?
It's just a terminal. So whenever I write, let's say Open Code, two terminals open. One is the TUI of the Open Code or Claude Code, and on the right is just a terminal where I can run commands. So 50-50 split.
Okay.
But the setup I was coming to is I don't use any sort of memory. I don't use any sort of agent definition by design, because I feel it's a double-edged sword. So no Obsidian walls whatsoever. If I have to give the same instruction to 10 different models, I am very happy to do it rather than giving them Obsidian vault with instructions having there. So I don't have an agent personas defined. If I want my current session to do planning, then I can explicitly say that, hey, you are a planner now, just do planning. That when that is done...
And then do you have it save the planning in case you need to repeat it? Do you store that information?
Okay. Yes. So that is on my Claude.md. So every time the plan is done and I approve the plan, save the plan, save a checklist, and then the sub-agents comes into the picture who are actually executing it and just matching it across the testing and matching it across the checklist. So I don't have a second brain. I don't want to have it. I don't have a super big memory or Obsidian vault or whatever. I also don't have agent personas where people really define in depth that you are a tester, you are a programmer, you are what. I just...
Yeah. I've heard of that. Yeah.
I just do it on the fly, however I feel on the project.
Okay, cool. Well, I want to save a little bit of time for the questions I ask everybody who comes on the show. What are you excited about that's happening in the world of Python?
That's a good one. Definitely async maturity. So in the world of web scripting, I've always ignored the async functionality of Python because I'd never really felt need of. But in the world of web scripting, I'm seeing that async is one thing that can unlock a lot of different things, parallelization. So I think...
Yeah, there's a lot of waiting in the web. Yeah,
so the async story of Python has really grown up. The async IO in specific, the callbacks, even the HTTPX and Fast API now all support async. That is really good. That is something that I'm really, I'm very looking forward to, even maturing the ecosystem. And I would say WebAssembly and Python integration. So that is something, because if you could run a Python bytecode on a web browser, I think that would unlock an entire different realm of possibilities that you can do, and you can also access CPUs and GPUs and whatnot. So I think it's in the PEP 816, so it has formalized, but there's also something called PyDiode for CPython WebAssembly. Yeah. So that's that.
I got an episode that's going to come out just before our conversation.
Looking
here,
forward to it.
Where I'm talking about it. I'm talking about the new version of PyDiode, which is really great. And then Simon Willison built a sandbox thing to basically do wild things and still feel safe locally.
Wow.
And he's using WASM and MicroPython
interesting.
To do it. And it's actually very, very cool, especially for somebody like you, like an experimenter. You'd be like, yeah, I want to try out stuff. And he's using Pluggy to do like plug-in stuff with it. And any of these kind of like things where you're like, well, I'd like it to have access to this, but not everything. It's like, you know, the idea of sandboxing.
Yeah, yeah.
I think running things in a browser also is great. So,
yeah, that's really good. I think I'm looking for a use case where web scraping could meet WebAssembly at some point. I would say this use case in my head where we're scraping like gigabytes of data, and WebAssembly could really help in that. So yeah, looking forward to that episode. I'm definitely looking for see what it could unlock.
Yeah, yeah.
And lastly, I would say Python meets hardware, always the soft spot for that. CircuitPython, MicroPython, and even running different libraries on Raspberry Pi. The boards are getting cheaper and unavailable at the same time, unfortunately.
they don't have a lot of RAM in them, and so they're still fairly inexpensive, which is good.
So these are the things I would say looking forward to in the Python ecosystem.
So I always ask this question of like, what do you want to learn next? Again, it doesn't have to be about coding. It could be whatever you're interested, but what do you want to learn next?
Not about the coding. I would say something on my mind for a very long time is learning to roast coffee. So I'm a huge, I'm a huge coffee.
What direction are you going? I had a friend who did, literally used like
really?
Air popcorn popper to try to do it. I don't think it turned out great.
I think I want to do it right from the get-go. So I would invest in this small tabletop coffee roaster called Alio Bullet R2. It's still expensive, but yeah, it's a good start because you can do all the profiling and it's automated, so you can run scripts on top of it. So two different worlds will meet. Really huge on brewing coffee and experimenting with coffee. So if I have to climb up the ladder, coffee roasting is the next thing that I'll do.
So what is your brew process? I have a Breville that Americanos with. It has a nice grinder in it, and I've had it for 7 years. I just baby the thing, and so I'm hoping it'll last me a very long time. It saved me a ton of money, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, definitely. I recently got my espresso machine, and I'm not going to coffee shops anymore. I'm just, you know, brewing at home.
Yeah.
So milk-based latte is definitely a soft spot for them. But if I have to brew manual, then V60 as well as AeroPress, inverted AeroPress. I think those are the two.
I've had AeroPress,
Those are the two.
Yeah, cool. All right, well, we're going to have a ton of resources and so forth, but what would you say is the best way people can follow your work online?
Just my blog, codeandsolder.com. It's codeandsolder.com. So coding and soldering, trying to combine these two worlds.
Yeah.
try to blog as much as possible, but yeah, everything should be there.
Well, Ian, it's been fantastic to talk to you. We'll definitely have you come back on and discuss what you're up to next.
Yeah, definitely. Likewise, really enjoyed talking to you. And looking forward to more such hangouts that we can do.
Yeah, cool. All right. And don't forget, try out HydraDB for free and start building ontology-aware agents. One API for all your AI memory and context use cases at hydradb.com/signup. I want to thank Ian for coming on the show this week. And I want to thank you for listening. If you like the episode, a great way to help us grow our audience is to share it with other Python users who you think might enjoy it. You can also leave a rating or a review on your podcast platform of choice. If you or your company are interested in sponsoring the podcast, you can find all the information at realpython.com/advertise. You can find show notes with links to the topics we spoke about inside your podcast player or at realpython.com/podcast. And while you're there, you can leave us a question or a topic idea. I've been your host, Christopher Bailey, and I look forward to talking to you soon.